had a lot of notes, but I'm not going to use them. I think he has so much to say that I want him to have the full time. We've been privileged at the Miller Center, and I wonder how many organizations anywhere have had this privilege of having two people who are generally known as spokesmen for peace in the case of the Palestinian point of view and experience, Ambassador Wilcox and now Mark Rosenblum on the Israeli experience. But he's done much more than that, and although he goes back to Israel 7 or 8 times each year, he just recently returned from a trip to the Middle East where he visited Israel, Syria, the West Bank and Gaza, and Jordan, met with and interviewed Ariel Sharon, King Abdullah II, Yasser Arafat, whom he's interviewed many, many times, Syrian cabinet members and foreign ministry officials. And I could go on in that vein. He's been as close to the scene as anybody I have known. And I think rather than a lengthy introduction, I'd simply like to turn the floor to him.
Thank you. On September the 11th, I was about to go into teaching my class on the political history of the modern Middle East. It was about 8:30 in the morning. It was near a library called the Rosenthal Library, Queens College of the City University of New York. And the library where my classroom is located on a bluff with a clear view, unobstructed view of Manhattan and the World Trade Center in particular. And I sat there with my students on a beautiful sunny day talking a little bit about their research assignments. This was going to be a class focusing on the birth of the modern Middle East and the contradictory commitments that were made for Palestine, Israel, and the Fertile Crescent. Class was going to be a discussion of a commitment the British made to the Zionists in the form of the Balfour Declaration. Second commitment that was made between the British themselves and the Sykes-Picot Agreement, how they would divide the Middle East largely between their two imperial powers. And then finally, yet a third contradictory agreement that was made between a British representative and a representative of the Arab National Movement. This was going to be a course talking about the ambivalences and deceptions that were part of the founding of the Middle East, the thrice promised promised land. And as 20 minutes went by and we started heading into class, the students noticed something had hit the World Trade Center. The next 3 or 4 hours we sat transfixed, watching not the birth of the modern Middle East, and my discussion and my course has since made an about face, and I've had to ask myself hard personal questions. The issue today of can the Israelis and the Palestinians make it from the battlefield to the negotiating table seems as if it's a subtext, seems as if it's a subheading, seems as if it's been subsumed in what my students and myself witnessed on September the 11th. So what I'll do today is try and share with you what I think is the mission at hand, the new world disorder that the younger Bush presidency has inherited, symbolized by the audacious and heinous attack on the United States. Because in some paradoxical way, I think what has happened, to use a quote that's in a small little booklet by Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense said, if a problem cannot be solved, enlarge it. What Osama bin Laden or any other of the terrorists might have done in this suicide terrorist attack is taken the Israeli-Palestinian problem, which seemed unresolvable, where the Israelis and the Palestinians have spent the last year literally beating each other's brains in without each of these two national groups succeeding in pursuing effectively their national missions. The death spiral seemed as if it needed to have some external hand come in and pull the throttle and save the Israelis and Palestinians from totally collapsing. And yet the presidency and critics of George W. Bush suggested that the president had removed himself from the Middle East. He didn't want to repeat the sins and the mistakes of the Clinton regime that invested years' worth of work. Some people felt investing a disproportionate amount of energy to end up with not a peace, but with a war that threatened the Middle East, which was then perceived as ground zero, and I'm choosing my terms carefully, because the real ground zero turned out to not be in Jerusalem, turned out not to be in Ramallah, turned out to be in Washington, D.C., and the World Trade Center in New York. And the paradox is that Donald Rumsfeld probably couldn't have imagined in his book, when he suggested if a problem cannot be resolved, enlarge it, that Osama bin Laden or other terrorists that will be identified, in fact, enlarge the problem in a way that will not serve their interests. D.C., once again, has current. It's alive with electricity, with intrusiveness, and with intervention in the Middle East, not primarily to help Jews and Arabs solve their problems in the modern Middle East, but to prevent the world from suffering an almost unimaginable new generation of world disorder. So I would open with the paradox that it's probably true that Israelis and Palestinians have virtually exhausted their capacity to help each other and to minimize their ravaging war against each other. Israelis and Palestinians live today in parallel and separate universes. They do not have a clue or an instinct for empathy, by and large, for the other. Each has a totally compartmentalized, segregated view of who's right and who's wrong. And each has undergone a profound political whiplash. I have undergone the same political whiplash myself. In July of 2000, most of the world was bracing for the final negotiating breakthrough between Israel's would-be general of peace, Ehud Barak, who was elected in 1996 in an overwhelming landslide victory, and people presumed he would be the second Israeli general following Rabin, who would finally put an end to the Hundred Years' War between the Israelis and the Palestinians. They met not far from here in Camp David, as you remember, for the better part of 2 weeks. The world went into that believing they would come up with at least a framework for a permanent solution. Instead, the last year, we've witnessed what amounts to a war. And both Israelis and Palestinians have completely, absolute, ideologically, diametrically opposed views of what went wrong. WWW, a small cottage industry, not a dot-com. But what went wrong in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiating effort is worth at least a word here from me, even though it's another whole discussion. But I think before I talk about the paradox and whether DC with current has a capacity to not only save itself and save the world from the heinous crime of global terrorism, but whether it has a chance to also rescue Israelis and Palestinians, it's worth a quick look back over my shoulder at why the Palestinian-Israeli breakthrough led instead to a breakdown in this horrific war. And I'm not pretending to give you all of the answers. I'll telegraphically identify for you several of things that went wrong, the Israeli rendition of what went wrong, to oversimplify, but not by much, is that what went wrong is that Barak offered Arafat the moon, a state in 95% of the West Bank and all the Gaza Strip, a capital in East Jerusalem, the right to some tens of thousands of Palestinians to return to pre-67 Israel, and certainly to what would be the Palestinian state in the future in the West Bank and Gaza. And in exchange for this heroic offer, in which Barak supposedly crossed every Israeli red line, Arafat responded with a merciless war, with a net and with violence, because he wanted more than 95%. From the Israeli perspective, it meant he wanted more than 100% of the West Bank and Gaza. In a word, the Israelis believe the Palestinians have finally shown their true colors. They don't want a state in the West Bank and Gaza and a capital in East Jerusalem living in peace next to the state of Israel, but an Islamic, broad, inclusive state instead of Israel. Crudely put, that's the way a very large majority of Israelis understand the brutal lesson of the last year of, instead of peace being at hand, they're engulfed in the war. There is no Palestinian partner. There is no plan for peace that's plausible. This is a tendency that has grown in Israel. This is a broad interpretation that doesn't capture all Israelis, but it gives you a sense of flavor of the context that catapulted Ariel Sharon to the prime ministership in even a larger landslide than Ehud Barak had won only 2.5 years before. The Palestinian perspective is diametrically opposed. They understand the offer that they got was a series of Bantustans, to use South African and apartheid language. They were given a series of segments of land parcels, all separated from each other, totally under the control of an occupation that now would be legitimated and made permanent. And they saw no right to their control of Jerusalem, and no right to the right of return. And worst of all, they looked at the offer and they said the offer is meaningless because whatever is on this piece of paper is undermined by the facts on the ground, the word Jewish settlements. Every place Palestinians looked, they argued, in the last 7 or 8 years, while negotiations for peace continued, the Israelis built and built and built, and the land that was the promise of their Palestinian state was in fact being turned into an expanded suburb of Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and the Israeli pre-67 borders. You have the classic symptom of two different national groups having a diametrically opposed view of what went wrong. Today they still remain locked into pointing their finger decidedly at the other side, you are to blame. And over the course of the last year, the Semitic center that was beginning to emerge in both the streets of Palestine and Israel, that is, people who were prepared to see a two-state solution with mutual recognition and fairness emerge, even with sharing the rule over Jerusalem as the capital of two states, this Semitic center in both Israel and Palestine has been put under pressure and is fragmented, and you now have significant pluralities, if not majorities, in both the street of Israel and Palestine that view the other once again in dehumanized and demonized terms. After 15, 20 years of personally working with hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians from all walks of life and having witnessed the gradual creation of the Semitic center between Jews, Muslims, and Arabs in the Holy Land, to see this fragmentation is, of course, a tragedy. So I will not go into a long song and dance of which perception, the Israeli mantra, we gave you peace, you, the Palestinians, gave us war, or the Palestinian mantra that said you gave us a tiny piece of land that would be a Bantustan to legitimate the occupation. There are elements of truth in both of these stories. For my money, the most dramatic facts that are not deniable about what went wrong have to do with Arafat's grievous failure to rein in violence and terrorism, incitement that many in the Israeli peace camp made a footnote. Let's not focus too much on it. After all, we're seeing a very embryonic Palestinian national polity emerge. Let's not treat it as if it's a full state with the apparatus and infrastructure of a modern government. Let's understand the baseline from which Arafat and the Palestinian National Movement comes from. Let's not hold it under a microscope and inspect it too critically. The problem is Arafat did not rein in, did not control Palestinians, not only of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. He also did not rein in sufficiently independent armed militias, today known as the Tanzim, a grouplet of Palestinian armed political factions centered in Ramallah, but not only in Ramallah. And these groups developed an ideological predisposition in the course of the last 2 or 3 years that said, we no longer have faith in negotiating anything with Israel, and we believe a war of independence is necessary. This tendency of a war for independence without negotiating stood cheek to jowl next to another tendency that began to emerge and get legitimacy in the last 2 to 3 years, a tendency that was not a war of liberation, a war of independence for a state in the West Bank and Gaza with East Jerusalem as capital, but a war of liquidation. If you look at public opinion polls today among the Palestinian population, the latest, most credible public opinion poll that I've seen comes from the Jerusalem Media and Communications Center, JMCC. It's housed in East Jerusalem. It does remarkable social science surveys. It's led by Rassan Khatib, who is one of the brightest, most pragmatic Palestinian nationalists. And the latest public opinion poll, interviewing some 1,100 Palestinians in a representative sampling from September the 11th to September the 18th, largely after, post the attacks on the Pentagon and the attacks on the World Trade Centers, shows for the first time Palestinians in larger numbers now support a struggle in this intifada for all of Palestine, and not a struggle for a state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip with East Jerusalem as its capital. This is an extremely dangerous tendency that represents a certain trend in Palestinian national politics. Arafat is partly responsible for not having reined in elements of incitement over the Palestinian radio and TV, and for also not reining in the violent guerrilla groups that were directly under his own authority, and incitement that was daily propagated over the Palestinian radio and TV. Arafat should not and cannot be given a pass for behavior that is unacceptable. This, in my opinion, does not turn him into Osama bin Laden Jr., and I'll talk more about that in a moment. But Arafat needs to be held accountable, and when I end with my very specific remarks of what Washington needs to do concretely and specifically in fighting the war against terrorism that has dramatic and direct implications for Israeli and Palestinian peacemaking, I'll refer to the specific demands that I think are fair and must be made on Arafat. On the Israeli side, the Palestinian criticism of settlements is trenchant and accurate. No matter how generous Barak's offer was, and I, for one, worked in other track two diplomatic channels on exactly the nature of the Barak offer, it was sweeping, it was dramatic. At the end of the day, it set the stage for President Bill Clinton's proposed blueprint for the Israeli-Palestinian final settlement. Barak was prepared to yield 95% of the West Bank, all of the Gaza Strip, and compensate another 2% to the Palestinians. If they're going to lose 5% of the West Bank, 2% at least would come out of pre-67 Israel to give the Palestinians 97% with land exchanges as the final figure for the West Bank and all of Gaza. This would require the removal of something in the order of 70 Jewish settlements and on the order of about 80,000 Jewish settlers being forced to be relocated. They would share Jerusalem and tens of thousands of Palestinians through Israeli security clearances would be given the right to return to within the pre-67 borders of Israel. This was a dramatic, serious, and authentic compromise on the part of Barak. But you do not deliver a piece of paper that is so sweeping and compromising and conciliatory when the facts on the ground demonstrate the opposite. The Palestinians had been living with this creeping accumulation of settlements so that from September 13, 1993, that famous reluctant handshake on the south front of the White House between President Arafat of the Palestinian Authority and Prime Minister Rabin, till today, there's been a doubling of the size of settlements, the number of Jewish settlers in the West Bank. So you can't present a map diplomatically that shows concession, conciliation, perhaps even beyond what most Palestinians thought Barak would be capable of. On the other hand, deliver a peace on the ground that shows a fracturing of the territories and rendered disbelief in the eyes and the ears of the Palestinians who were hearing this generous offer. The maps on the negotiating table did not match the maps on the ground. There was cognitive dissonance for most Palestinians that said, I don't get how we're going to get to this map you've handed me on a piece of paper, given what you have been unrelentlessly engaging in terms of settlement expansion. 15 minutes ago, a plane landed in an airport not far from Jerusalem with a team from the Peace Now Settlement Watch that was up in the air doing its latest study of what was happening on the ground under this Israeli government. There have been 60 illegal settlements that have taken place in the last 6 years in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm not talking about approved settlements, but ones that the Defense Ministry had never approved of. And since the election of Sharon, there had been 17 illegal settlements, and in the last 3 months, 6 more illegal settlements have taken place. This suggests there is a serious problem on the Israeli side, and it renders suspect the proposals that any Israeli government would come to the table. So in the back of my mind, the what went wrong story has very much an interface, a mutual breakdown on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side. Arafat's reluctance and unwillingness to really rein in violence and terrorism and to own up to his public opinion and to say exactly what the concessions are the Palestinians would have to swallow, because they were not going to get exactly 100% of what they demanded. Arafat never engaged in a serious educational campaign that prepared the Palestinian public for the kinds of give and take in the negotiations, and the Israelis, for their part, undermined their own generous, compelling offer between July of 2000 and January of 2001, when they created facts on the ground and continue to create facts on the ground today that continue to exacerbate any possibility of credible renewed negotiations. But beyond the what went wrong scenario and trying to identify very casually each side's contribution to the undermining of a credible final negotiating settlement, I want to spend the bulk of my time talking about the paradox I identified at the outset, the paradox of how the tragedy in Washington and New York has led to what I've characterized as DC with current. On the way over here, I just scoped out a few of the things that strike me as a bold, ambitious agenda that represents what might be considered Machiavellian politics. If at the end of the day, there's going to be a peace process, and it's going to be a successful global coalition against terrorism, it's going to have to be based on, by and large, Machiavellian insights and interests. And I take this concept of Machiavellianism to have tremendous applicability to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There's one hero, one man whose name will not be a household word that rolls off your ears. It's Major General Yehoshaphat Harkabi. He was an advisor to 3 Israeli prime ministers, a very celebrated general and strategic thinker, a hawk of all the hawks. In fact, he had written some of the most famous strategic analysis in the 1960s and 70s, explaining why the bulk and the broad band of the Arab and the Islamic world would not recognize the Jewish state of Israel, period. He, by the late 1970s, began to articulate a completely different line. He said that he was a Machiavellian dove. He was a dove for hawkish reasons. Let me explain for a moment, because it seems to me this is the rub. This is what will, in my opinion, lead the Americans to play a central role in not simply getting revenge, but in creating a global coalition against terrorism that will redound to the benefit of peacemaking between Israelis and Palestinians, very much along the lines of Yehoshaphat Harkabi, this major general in Israel who considered himself a Machiavellian dove, or a dove for the hawkish reasons. Harkabi looked at the map and said, There's no way that we can continue to rule over the West Bank and Gaza and the 2 million Palestinians there and still maintain the primordial desire of the state of Israel and the Jews in that state. That is to have a demographically majority Jewish population in that state. If Israel annexed or insisted on continuing to control the West Bank and Gaza, by the year 2008, he surmised by demographic studies then, the majority of the population between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, the land that the Israeli right wing covets and does not want to give back, Jews will become a minority in that very land. And then they will have a choice, either to become an apartheid state, deny citizenship, voting rights, and empowerment to the Palestinian majority that lives between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, or to engage in worse ethnic cleansing and expulsion of Palestinians, or third, accept a binational state where Jews are a minority. None of those three options was digestible, was conceivable from the eyes of Yehoshaphat Arkabi. Hence, the only solution, to put it in a nutshell, was either there will be a Palestinian state in the neighborhood, or Israel will become the Palestinian state. He preferred to have Israel remain an independent state, have a Palestinian state emerge in the West Bank and Gaza, and negotiate this deal with Arafat. He was doing this not out of a social ethic of a Mother Teresa, but a vital strategic assessment made by a Machiavellian raw self-interest. This is the state of public opinion that had dominated Israel until the last year in the violent Intifada. Most Israelis, rightly or wrongly, were interested in spectacular dramatic concessions to their Palestinian brethren across the other side of the divide, not because they had become converted social workers of the variation of Mother Teresa, but because they become Machiavellian doves like Yehoshaphat Arkabi. The only way to salvage a demographically Jewish state was to recognize Palestinian self-determination to be realized within a state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And this was going to be done, not for the reasons that have to do primarily with morality. It had to do with vital strategic interests. That still is the most compelling truth that dominates Israeli politics. The Israelis today, while they have taken on much more hard-line positions, still subsume to the truth that if there is a way of separating from the Palestinians and giving them their nation in the sun, in the West Bank and Gaza, including a capital East Jerusalem, with significant return to the West Bank and Gaza, and with selective return to Israel itself, I'm convinced, and public opinion polls bear it out, they would leap at the opportunity, not because they have an excess of moral fiber, but because they still are motivated by the rock-bottom desire to live in a state the majority whose citizens are Jews. And this is unimaginable if they continue to rule over the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And that is what awaits to be reactivated, and I think that President George W. Bush is on the way of compelling that kind of orientation once again in Israel. And I want to end here now, give you some indications of why the Americans have rekindled this very quickly and what the American agenda should be. In my opinion, this is primarily not a military response that the Americans are engaged in. I have no doubt that there will be a target, and there will be a trigger, and there will be military force that will be used. I hope that that force has a real target that's a villain on the other end. It must have very, very strict attention to civilian casualties that could occur to this, because if we lose a broad global coalition against terrorism, the Americans will find that smart bombs and military weaponry is wholly unable to rein in the villain. We need intelligence and we need information. And intelligence and information does not exist today in the Pentagon, in the CIA, in American intelligence communities. It exists with the locals. It exists with the Afghanis. It exists with the Northern Alliance. It exists with the Saudis. It exists with the Egyptians. It exists with the Jordanian intelligence. And yes, it even exists in the Palestinian Authority. And without an inclusive global alliance against terrorism that includes the Arab and the Islamic force, the military force that will be used will be largely irrelevant and counterproductive, because this is a war that will not be won or lost with smart bombs, but with smart politics. The smart politics I'd identify for you immediately turn our attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I make a short list of what smart politics is defined by in Washington today. And I hope that this administration, along with its effort led by Secretary of State Powell to put together such an inclusive global alliance against terrorism, includes the following components. The United States should issue what amounts to a Balfour Declaration for the Palestinians. This president needs to say that American vital interests and international rights recognize the Palestinian right to self-determination. The Balfour Declaration was what the British gave to the Zionists in 1917. In the year 2001, this administration needs to do that in a way that is consistent with our obligations and vital relationships with Israel. And I'll explain how in a minute. The Americans need to rebuild their bilateral relationships with the Palestinians as part of this coalition to fight a global battle against terrorism. More than the Balfour Declaration, secondly, the administration ought to now use the S word, a Palestinian state. We need to say at the end of the game what the Americans imagine a permanent peace negotiated between the Palestinians and the State of Israel will lead to is not only Israeli security, but Palestinian statehood. Ariel Sharon, 7 days ago, uttered the S word, statehood. The state he has in mind for the West Bank and Gaza is much different than the viable state that I think is necessary, but at least the language of statehood must enter now the American lexicon at the highest presidential level. Thirdly, the United States needs to also create a task force, part of the global alliance against terrorism that's being developed, must have a task force within this global alliance to oversee the ceasefire, the fragile ceasefire that was announced last week. And you'll remember that only 3 days ago, the foreign minister of Israel, Shimon Peres, finally met with Yasser Arafat. This was a meeting that many in Israel were loath to see happen because they believed it was a saving of Arafat once again, a re-legitimation of the Palestinian Authority. Well, we have a necessity here of the Americans being the leading an oversight committee that would grow out of this global alliance against terrorism that will oversee the ceasefire, because one of the structural flaws of the Oslo Accords, one of the two central structural flaws of the Oslo Accords the last 8 years, has been there is no adjudicating power. The Israelis and Palestinians are presumed like cousins in battle. They will now make peace, and they will themselves decide who committed a wrong, who's to be charged with transgressing and violated one of the hundreds of detailed agreements in Oslo. This will not happen. Today, particularly with the scar tissue that Israelis and the Palestinians have accumulated against each other, there must be a third party that looks at the ceasefire and says, I will help the Israelis and the Palestinians set up a mechanism for adjudicating and overseeing the ceasefire. Unless that is done, there will not be a truce or a ceasefire that will hold between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And if that ceasefire does not hold, what do you imagine the chances are of the Islamic and the Arab countries remaining active, inclusive participants in the global American battle against terrorism? Zero. The tragedy and the paradox of the moment is Yasser Arafat once again finds himself in a birdseat with potential enormous power and vulnerability as well. The Americans are for a reason quite anxious to find Arafat, not as a junior bin Laden, but to test him to see if he really can rein in the local terrorists in Hamas and Islamic Jihad and within his own Palestinian overlapping security bodies, because he does not want the question of Palestine to resonate on the streets of Islamabad, in Cairo, in the Arab or Islamic world. Because if there are Palestinians that are perceived to being victimized locally on the ground, it will fracture, I think, fundamentally the necessity of creating this inclusive Islamic Arab involvement in the global battle against terrorism. Demands on Arafat to be included in this coalition, very specifically. Arafat must make an announcement. He can no longer talk out of both sides of his mouth. As America recognizes a Palestine state as the goal of the process and issues an American Balfour Declaration and sends American-led mediators in the context of a global coalition against terrorism to monitor the ceasefire in the West Bank and Gaza, he also needs to demand, Arafat needs to hear the demand and honor it. He will go on national Palestinian radio and TV, speaking in Arabic, and announce the end to all violence associated with this intifada. The Palestinians should have the right to resist occupation, but not through terrorism, violence, and armed struggle. There is a line that has been drawn in the sand on September the 11th. People have a right to resist things that are unfair, but not through violence and terrorism and force of arms. Arafat has a chance to use an international coalition to be a part of it to get his day in court and to battle against the occupation. A speech in Arabic on Palestinian Authority radio and TV, not renouncing his goal of a state, not renouncing his desire to end the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza by the Israelis, but an end to all acts of violence and terrorism. And this needs to be done in Arabic, and part of now what the American-led task force will do in the West Bank and Gaza is monitor Arafat's performance on the ground indeed to make sure that he finds other ways of engaging in armed struggle. Today, a group of Palestinians called for a new form of nonviolent resistance. They're asking for 200,000 Palestinians to march to the outskirts of their capital, East Jerusalem, with protest signs and pickets, not rocks, not stones, not mortars, not bullets. Legal, non-lethal, civil disobedience, right to resist the occupation through these means. Up until now, Arafat has not endorsed this. He must reject armed violent struggle and will be judged accordingly. Secondly, a demand on the Arab world and the Islamic world, the Gulf states must be compelled to dry up their funding for the terrorists within their countries. It's not just the Osama bin Ladens and the network of global terrorists. It's also Hamas and Islamic Jihad that challenge the Palestinian Authority's rule in the West Bank and Gaza that is armed, financed, and given support among nationals in Saudi Arabia and particularly the Gulf states. Those Gulf states, as a price of being on our side in the global struggle against terrorism, must now dry up this support and renounce it. That also must be monitored. That also must be overseen by a committee. Smart politics at the end of the day, not smart bombs, will have to prevail. Some of what I've outlined briefly are the American obligation, hopefully in smart politics. They'll also, I think, involve a very painful long-term ideological struggle. There are now people who are in America wanting to play the blame game of either saying in the most despicable way that somehow there are Americans and Muslims and Arabs among us or other places in the world that are stereotypically the enemy. We've seen this, and we've seen this ugly face episodically in the United States. President Bush has been dramatic, effective, and principled in condemning this. But I think there's another danger here. And that other danger, besides blaming Arabs and Muslims for this, instead of blaming terrorists, it's to also blame Israel. The United States would have been targeted both in the Pentagon and in the World Trade Centers on September 11th, even if there had not been a November 1947, United Nations General Assembly creating two states, including the State of Israel. Even if the State of Israel was not a spot on a map, the people that pursued this act were pursuing other American vital interests and challenging them. They were challenging a host of regimes in the Middle East that we identify as vital allies, from the Gulf states, including the Saudis, to Egypt, to Jordan. The Americans are in a very dangerous moment domestically here, where we're looking for pointing of fingers and assessing blame. I'm very troubled by people talking about blaming either wing of the Semitic community in the Middle East. We need to be specific and focus on who the targets and the enemies are. The enemies here, to be very specific, are a group of murderous, suicidal, patriarchal fundamentalists. And perhaps there are 5,000 to 10,000 of them in the planet Earth. And they need to be rooted out, but they can be rooted out less with military weapons, in my opinion, even though they will be selectively necessary, and more by creating a political environment that renders them unacceptable in their local political environments. This means the bulk of the cultural educational struggle is going to be part of the global inclusive network against terrorism that includes Arab and Islamic leaders. We need to have an anti-defamation league internationally that is mobilized of imams, of priests, of rabbis, of clerics from all religions and all walks of life to challenge every one of the international and regional groupings to take a stand against what is unacceptable behavior inconsistent with their holy books and their religion. We need holy men to engage in this. This is not just a secular, temporal struggle. It's a struggle that must enjoin those religious leaders, particularly in the Arab and Islamic world. And there are voices that are willing to be heard and are speaking, even as they are challenged and even as they represent risks to the people that are articulating this. The Islamic head of the Islamic movement in Israel, a man by the name of Darwish, has issued a fatwa saying this is against Islam. The head of El-Azhar University, a Muslim cleric, has done the same. We need to mobilize and challenge these regional international bodies. At the end of the day, I'll end with a comment here, that I think that there is an enormous hope associated with an American challenge now. In some very tragic way, I went to bed with my children September the 10th, convinced the United States stood for unscathed. And we woke up on September the 11th by late morning understanding that the world had come to America. The idea of a homeland defense is almost anti-historical from an American point of view. Our very notion of the nation standing and defending itself is now viscerally, organically connected to understanding our world as we understood it as a protected bubble is not the same as the world. And we now have to join the world with our allies. And those allies are very available in the Arab and the Islamic, the Israeli and the Jewish world. And we need to polarize this debate. And I'll use a concluding quote from the Labour Party apparent prime ministerial candidate Avram Borg, an Orthodox religious Jew who's catapulted to the head of the leadership of the Labour Party, who recently was asked in the middle of the bloodletting, of the murder and the mayhem, Avram, why do you still, Avram was a Peace Now activist, a member of the largest, longest lived extra-parliamentary Israeli peace movements. And he was asked, Avram, it's not 1978, it's 2001. The Palestinians have bloodied and brutalized you. We're fighting a war against them. Why do you still talk as if there are Palestinian partners and Arabs that we can negotiate with as Jews? And Avram's answer was, I go back to 1929, where his mother and father lived in Hebron, an important religious city for Jews, and a massacre occurred in Hebron. On one side of his family, the local Palestinian Arab Muslims decimated and butchered his family. The other side was saved by Arabs and Muslims in Hebron. And Avram says, wherever you go, you have a choice to make at the end of the day. Do you choose to empower and strengthen that half of the other side or more that are your allies? Or do you choose to weaken them and strengthen and empower the half that are against you? And this is exactly where the battle lines are drawn. Can the United States mobilize a global coalition against terrorism that challenges all of our allies to not make glib, stereotypical assumptions? Because at the end of the day, we need to make sure that if we go in and fight an element of Taliban fighters, we do not turn the Afghanistan people into our enemy. If we fight against Hamas and Islamic Jihad, we have to make sure the Palestinians are not transformed into the enemy. So at the end of the day, I leave with Avram Borg's quote, that the challenge of world leadership and smart politics today is to isolate and marginalize those thousands of murderers who stalk the planet of the earth and mobilize a coalition that is global in network, inclusive as of Arab and Islamic brothers and sisters, and that this is a battle that will be largely fought on the cultural and political levels for probably the rest of my life. Thank you.
Charlie Smith.
That was one of the most remarkable and thought-provoking presentations I've heard. If one of these or a group of terrorists decide, isn't this the time to assassinate Arafat?
There is a possibility that, particularly if Arafat seemingly, after three false starts, seems to, for every reason, and I've met with Arafat 70, 80 times in small rooms, one-on-one, and you never know which performance you have seen because he's very theatrical. But for whatever his motivation, there is evidence that he has gotten the message and there is an attempt to change behavior. And when he does that, he doesn't have the support of at least a significant part of Hamas and all of Islamic Jihad and military undergrounds. So the question of his life is not inappropriate. I think that there is not yet a succession clearly in place. There's a formal succession process that we know, and I could tell you that, that grows out of the ruling institutions of the Palestinian elected authority in the legislative body and the Speaker of the House of that Palestinian Council, who would be the transitional replacement. Anyone that would kill Arafat at this stage is probably sealing their own death warrant. Arafat today is less popular than he's ever been in Palestinian public opinion polls. Yet he's the only one that at all represents Mr. Palestine in terms of trust and public opinion support. And anyone that kills him, and it's traceable that their fingerprints are on it, will disqualify that body, that group, from any legitimation in the succession struggle after Arafat's murdered. So the break on killing Arafat, if there is a break, is the break of undergoing delegitimation. Because with all the corruption, with all the nepotism that surrounds Arafat and the absence of democracy and the commitment to an Arafatocracy, which is very authoritarian rule and divide and conquer, with all of those negative things, he still is the one and only Mr. Palestine, and you run the risk of forever being the public enemy of virtually every Palestinian if your name is on the bullet.
Next question. Other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I guess the concern concerns me is I think a lot of people agree with what you say. You think the American public has willingness to understand this and give this process time especially if there are more terrorist attacks.
I don't relish the idea of saying this, but I think it needs to be said because the point here is honesty. And I think, like has been said about Israel, by its generals, by its security people, by its educators that want to tell the truth, is in Israel the question is not if there will be another terrorist attack, but when. And I fear that's what the reality is in the United States, and we kid ourselves if we don't think and be prepared for the long haul, including subsequent heinous acts of murderous terrorism. And I think it really is largely contingent on our leaders and the institutional fabric of our society, that our leaders have to be honest with us. They have to prepare for the worst as they bring out the best in us. And I don't have a doubt that there's an awful lot special that resides in Americana. I think we are an extraordinary people. The know-nothingness among us is smaller amounts of know-nothingness than many other countries, than most other countries. Most Americans want to do right, want to do well. And I think in some sense, most Americans know there's no return to normalcy, even though they quite don't know what the new life brings. And it's going to depend on the president, the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, whatever differences we have, and there are real ones, there already is a significant cleavage that we've all observed in our own national leadership on the nature of the coalition. And I've made a very strong case, almost a precondition case, that without an inclusive global coalition that includes Arab and Islamic forces, that the battle against terrorism will not be fought and won. And there are others that really are more concerned about preventing a veto power the international coalition would have over military action. And there are some cleavages between the defense and State Department. Some of these are traditional bureaucratic cleavages, some are personal, but there are real differences. Whatever the differences are, your question can only be answered when we look at how the leadership of this nation responds to it. And here I'm talking also about religious leaders. It's those constituencies that are most likely to say, take the long leash off me. I don't want patience. I want a strike. I want vengeance. I want some drama, some military action. When the body bags start to come back, when our casualties start to become real on the battlefield and they grow in America, there will be huge strains. And I don't see any alternative from the top and coming from the religious community. Every church, and that's why I have tremendous hope and put an incredible amount of priority on the religious communities in this nation working with national leaders to prepare us for what I think is the long-term challenge that's ahead. This is the great fear. Quotable now was Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was sitting in the White House thinking about the war in Vietnam, and says by one of his counselors, history tells us we're not going to be in this in the long run. And the long run is what we have to be in this. And I don't have any glib answers other than to tell people. And this is also a private, personal family thing. I have children. My children are of an age as young adults that I can share with them what I fear. My ideas are to share the fears that I have without immobilizing them, with giving them positive ways they still can live life. That has to be done in family units, in churches, in mosques, and synagogues, by the president. We've just begun to see this unfold, and I don't have a better answer, because if our institutions, secular and religious, do not hold, if the center does not hold, to use an old expression, in keeping our country focused on what's right and what's required, because what is required is not simply dropping bombs and striking out. We have to have a real target with some evidence that persuades our allies to keep this coalition together. It's an American coalition. Without unity in America, there is no global network against terrorism. And I think we're talking about what you're asking me a question that is so profound about what the building blocks are that constitute a nation that exists and remains in a solid and a solid state at a time of unprecedented struggle. I don't have the answer. You'll see it in terms of homes. You'll see it in terms of churches and synagogues and mosques from Friday through Sunday. And the president, we're hopefully going to hear messages like we've heard from the White House.
We've got three questions. Let's see if we can get them all in. Cliff Byes, Dr. Edgerton, and Bob Burnett.
Given the history of international organizations and international alliances and domestic politics, is it realistic to assume that there can be a global alliance against terrorism?
Yes, I think there can be a global alliance against terrorism. And I think that here I'm not talking about 60 countries that all are part of a special operations unit joining the Green Beret and the SEALs somewhere in the mountains of Afghanistan. I'm talking about very selective engagement on a military level that's very concrete, that's very specific, and I'm not looking for, nor do I think are the Americans looking for, actual combat coordination and unity of purpose on the battlefield in terms of being parts of actual fighting units. What I'm expecting, and I think is possible, is the sharing of intelligence and information. My understanding, for whatever it's worth, and my linkages with people who should know something, is that many of our best leads that we have today since September 11th have come from exactly those countries that will not join us on the field of battle, that provide us with the I&I intelligence information I referred to. This is the single most important contribution that can be made. So when I talk about a global coalition against terrorism, I'm not talking about a supra-military world army. I'm talking about specific nations finding ways that they can plug in and make a contribution to be on the side of the coalition against terrorism. And there are a variety of things that these nations can do and some things that they cannot do and that we shouldn't ask them to do, because we know that the mere asking goes public and makes it impossible for them to do something of another lesser, not even a lesser order, but of a different order than military engagement. Because I've suggested the most important engagement here is not going to be on the field of battle. And yes, a real coalition is quite possible. And that's why I brought us back to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because I think the precondition for keeping that coalition together, getting the intelligence information and research that we need from the Arab and Islamic world, is going to be very directly linked to our ability to sustain a ceasefire and to see that ceasefire culminate into some renewed negotiating process and keeping a vision alive of what a permanent agreement between the Palestinians and Israelis would look like. That is part of the smart bombs and smart politics that we can use, and there are lots of things those countries can do. So I see a differentiated task of America talking to the Saudis, asking them one thing. The Americans talking to the United Arab Emirates, asking another thing. The Americans talking to the Egyptians, these are very discreet, and you have to bundle them together into a coalition. Yes, this is not only possible, if it's impossible, it's hard for me to imagine adjusting to any new kind of normalcy in the new world.
Dr. Edgerton?
Do we know at any time in the past whether the U.S. government has made a firm offer to Israel to provide military protection if, in return, they would agree to go along with establishing a Palestinian state, taking their sons out of the West Bank? If that's not been offered, why not? And if it were offered, how would Israel respond?
I think it's never been offered. But the trade-offs have been clearly understood, and they've been acted out in a transparent way on the political stage. After the Gulf War, for example, when then Prime Minister Shamir honored the first demand of the president during the Gulf War, keep your phantoms. My nephew was a fighter pilot in the Israeli Air Force. He sat, like many Israelis did, strapped into his phantom on the airport, on the tarmac in Israel, with instructions, you don't go up unless you get some kind of authorization from the Prime Minister, who will be in constant coordination on the hotline with the President of the United States. The Israelis were told, stay out of this. The coalition we have is contingent on your not making yourself Israel, the issue by retaliating against Saddam Hussein. And Yitzhak Shamir, who was probably in the scale of rascally, tough-minded, independent, hardline Israeli prime ministers, was at the top. He got the message, and he behaved accordingly. After the Gulf War was over, the United States was trying to negotiate a package, and they said, settlement freeze, or you lose $10 billion of loan guarantees. Here's a linkage that was done in the most dramatic way, as far as I know, it's ever been done in American foreign policy. Where an Israeli prime minister was told by President of the United States, Bush Sr., the $10 billion you desperately need in loan guarantees to absorb the 1 million Russian immigrants and to strengthen your infrastructure are now totally contingent on a settlement freeze across the board. No new settlements to be built. Shamir refused. And the result was, in my opinion, almost a one-to-one correlation. He lost the Israeli election. In my, the great card America has here and has to use very carefully and very precisely, no sitting Israeli prime minister can, in a moment of transparent crisis, snub his nose at the president. And if the president chooses to use this ultimate weapon, which is directly speaking to the Israeli public below their prime minister, and say, your prime minister was just given a choice, $10 billion of loan guarantees versus freezing settlements. Do you know what he just chose? Do you agree with him or not? The Israeli public chose to not agree with their prime minister. And in general, this will be the case. The Israelis understand who their lifeline is. They also understand the political culture they value that's in America. And while there is some resentment at America from time to time, there is this enormous leverage the United States has. It's leverage I think President Bush has and is using in an effective way at this moment through Secretary of State Colin Powell. I do not think you need to say to the Israelis, we're going to deny you our security umbrella unless you do A, B, and C. It's enough to identify a policy of a sitting prime minister that's already suspect in Israel. The majority of the Israeli Jews do not feel strengthened or supportive of the massive Jewish settlement campaign in the West Bank and Gaza. It's already a weak card for Sharon to play. And you will see Thursday, unless it's buried in the next 24 hours, there will be a huge campaign around new Jewish settlements that Sharon has allowed to emerge in the last 2 months. Bush will not, in my opinion, Bush cannot afford to let that go unanswered. And he will now have a battle with Sharon. Hopefully it will be done quietly, and Sharon will be compelled to remove those settlements. So I think there already is a track record of positive American intervention in Israeli politics, including security politics, in a way that is sensible, speaks to the Israeli public, in a way that the Israeli public doesn't have a nationalist backlash against the Americans. Because what you want to have happening here, that's consistent with my theme, if I'm right, you don't want to polarize Israel also in a way that the hawkish tendency is empowered. The nature of the American intervention when it comes has to speak authentically and empathetically to Israeli security concerns, so that you want to have the majority of the Israelis saying, you're right, Mr. President, our prime minister is wrong. And there is now a lot of room for the President of the United States to play the role that William Jefferson Clinton, warts and big warts and all, that Clinton had. He was brilliant in maintaining a bilateral relationship with the Palestinians and beloved in the streets of Israel. This is the challenge of an American president.
Final question, Bob.
Very small. First, I echo Charlie Smith's comments on the quality and relevance of your presentation. Excellent point. More an observation than a question. A lot of us, I think, were probably somewhat disturbed by the demonstrations that went forward in the streets of Washington last weekend and had to swallow twice. But I think we do have to recognize that if we really believe that we have freedom of expression in this country, it's got to be across the board, even when you see the words that are on the sign. We spoke about some of the demonstrators. I think maybe more than some things, that illustrates the depth of freedom and commitment to that principle that we enjoy so much in this country.
Look, I, as a university professor and as someone who has a reputation as putting great value in diplomacy and in the kind of smart politics, in contrast to smart bombs here, and being identified with the mainstream Israeli peace movement, I think it's very important to struggle with, in a dialogue, those people who are out in the streets. This is a profound intellectual discourse and a battle of ideas. And I will not relent to my Jewish students, to my Arab and Islamic students. There is a line here I strongly believe, and that we have to continue to have a discourse about this in this country. And we can't clamp down on these voices or others. And the discourse has to end in the battle of the better ideas that more serve our nation's interest.
I think we've come to our adjournment time, but we want to thank you for, I think all of us agree, a very moving and inspiring presentation.
Thank you.